The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. Well, Jackie, it was a long day yesterday.
Yeah, we had a really early call. I think we started at 6:30 and you did your book club.
I did. Yeah, it was a very long day, but it was a good book club, the Energy File book club, for those of you in the audience that don't know. Is a forum where 20, 25 people get together. I moderate the session and we talk about issues that are relevant to energy matters, the transition, and we use the Energy File collection as the basis for the conversation. Yesterday, we talked about what it would take for people to switch out appliances in their home, which is increasingly a topic of conversation as we think about electrification and this energy transition. And that also was part of a side conversation, which actually dominated eventually, which was, what is the gap in understanding between consumers of energy and suppliers of energy and where they get their energy? And so if you go to energyfile.org, you can sign up for the book clubs. We do them once every couple of weeks.
Yeah, and they're in the evenings.
Yeah, they're in the evenings and you meet new friends and it's actually quite engaging. It's also very prescient to this conversation we're about to have with a very special guest, this understanding of where things come from behind the scenes, because we've had a lot of questions, Jackie, haven't we, on electric vehicles?
We still are getting questions on electric vehicles, so we are going to have that podcast. Thanks for your questions. But one of the questions we often get is around the batteries and the minerals that go in them, especially because I know we've been watching that a lot of these commodities have gone up in their price recently. And it draws to the question, you know, there's this idea that battery costs are going to continue to be driven down, but what happens if the inputs start going up? What does that inflation do to the ability to transition to more batteries?
Yeah, the minerals in particular, well, lithium is the one that comes to mind, but there's all sorts of other metals like nickel, cobalt, and there's various grades of nickel that are available. And the question is, as we get this very rapid ramp up in electric vehicles, because, you know, an electric vehicle battery is about 5,000 times the size of an average cell phone battery. So the pull on minerals is really quite dramatic. And we've talked about that before in the program, but we decided to bring in the expert, and it's someone that I've known for several years, and I'm delighted that he has agreed to join us straight from London, UK. Simon Moores is the Managing Director of Benchmark Mineral Intelligence, and if you don't follow this publication, I really encourage our audience to do. The subscription is really fabulous in terms of the insights it provides and the conferences they put on. I've been, and I got to tell you, I learned so much from it. So Simon Moores, Managing Director, Benchmark Mineral Intelligence. Welcome.
Excellent. Thank you, Peter and Jackie, for having us on your podcast.
Maybe, Simon, for the benefit of our audience, tell us a bit about Benchmark Mineral Intelligence. I know Peter has gone to your conferences. We've used your research, but just tell the audience a little bit. And we will put a link to your website in the show notes for people to check out.
We set up Benchmark in 2015 to collect sensitive market data on the supply chain for lithium-ion batteries. You know, it's something that I've done all my career since 2006 is the research side of minerals and their supply chains, and especially lithium and graphite. And then in 2014-15, I decided that the battery and EV supply chain needed more focus, more data. And the types of data it needed were sensitive price data to help people write these numbers in contracts and help to negotiate. An independently set price was key, and that's one of the big things we do now. And then also people wanted to know about batteries. So we collected data on battery cells. People wanted to know about cathodes and anodes, then the chemicals, and of course, all the raw materials that go into them. So we built this complete publication, complete business solely for the battery supply chain. And we're the only guys in the world that do that.
And I mean, there's a lot of different components in a battery, and a lot of them are based on commodities. So why don't we start with sort of where the price of some of these key commodities are going, and then we'll lead into what it means for the actual battery. So, you know, one of the things that I follow among the many commodity indicators is, for example, the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index. It's doubled off its pandemic lows. It's just past a five-year high. It's a basket of all sorts of commodities. Some people are calling for a commodity super cycle, sort of what happened circa 2011. Cobalt, for example, has gone up sharply from $15 to $25 a pound in the past couple months. I mean, the sharp rise is really quite dramatic. Give us a sketch of what's going on with some of the vital minerals and metals market for the EV supply chain.
I think you've got a twofold thing going on here. You've, of course, got the start of what people are calling a commodity super cycle. The way I kind of view it, it isn't just a China story anymore, like the last super cycle that we're familiar with, but also now it's a regional one, right? So like what China have done by building its industrial heartland over the last 20 years, Europe needs to do this and North America needs to do this, but for this electrification trend, or let's say renewable energy, energy storage revolution. And that's a massive driver of, I think, what's happening in what people are calling the super cycle. And of course, a major component of that is electric vehicles. And of course, what is an electric vehicle? It's a battery on wheels. So unsurprisingly, people have seen there's been a lot more attention on EVs now. Sales have gone through the roof, especially since October, November last year. And what happens when demand goes up? The demand and the prices for the key inputs go up. Lithium is up 70% within China, lithium carbonate, over the last 2 months, 70% in 2 months. Cobalt, similar, is like 67-8% for the same reasons. And those two minerals or elements or commodities, we call them specialty chemicals, really. But those two ones really are driven by electric vehicles, and they are the proxy. They're the ones to watch if you want to know what's really happening with the demand for EVs. It's an EV-powered commodity supercycle.
So, Simon, is this all in anticipation of demand that's in the future, or is the demand going up at a level that warrants these type of price increases?
No, this is real demand now that's driving it. And what you had is you've had a 3 to 4 years of falling prices in the key battery metals, like lithium and cobalt especially. And that's a result of the last boom, if you like, 2015-16. There was lithium's price spiked and there was investment and new supply came on stream, and then there was oversupply. And it's taken that long for the demand to catch up. The problem is there hasn't been any investment, hardly any investment going forward, because the way these mines and the supply side build out is on 3 to 4 year horizons. But of course, EVs, you know, are growing on 10-year horizons in growth spurts. And so you're going to have these moments where probably every 3 to 4 years where demand massively overshoots supply. And as a result, these mineral prices don't go up by like 10 or 15%. They go up 4, 5, 6 times. And it's quite aggressive, quite volatile, but it's the way it is.
Yeah, that's just like most commodity markets. Certainly, we're familiar with that in the oil markets over the last many decades. You know, you sort of just go through a certain threshold of marginal supply and then the price just goes up exponentially.
It's the scarcity price, right?
It's the scarcity price. And I mean, the pull on the EV metals and minerals supply chain is just at the bottom of the inflection point at the moment. So I can sort of imagine what's going to potentially happen. We'll come to that. I want to come to what mines are being built out in anticipation and so on. But talk a little bit also about graphite, because it's a special kind of graphite that's only found in certain parts of the world that's also required.
Graphite is the number one input into a lithium-ion battery by volume. Everyone likes to look at it by value, I think, and break a battery down by that. But really, we look at the kilograms that go into a battery, translating to the number of mines and the tonnages that need to be built. But graphite, and graphite which goes in to make an anode, a battery is an anode and a cathode rolled together, effectively. So this anode side is all graphite. It might have a sprinkle of silicon, but it's all graphite, and that comes in two forms, either in natural or synthetic. If it's natural, it comes from the ground, and it comes from a flake graphite is the raw material. Now, this proves graphite is the most complex input supply chain out of all battery raw materials, because this is why it's a specialty chemical, a specialty material industry and not a commodity. Is you dig flake graphite out of the ground, you can't use all of it, you can only use certain sizes of flake. And then you're dictated by the purities, or more importantly, the impurities that are in that flake. Once you can individually pick out this flake of graphite, the mine you have to put it through extensive processing. So very much a speciality game.
Yeah, and it's only in certain geographies.
So the vast majority of graphite is from China. We have about 65% of graphite coming from China. There's one other big mine in Mozambique, which is Cyber Resources, which is a very important big mine to look at and actually pretty new as well. But again, that material is going into China also. China is very graphite hungry. And I think the key thing is that anode precursor step, China produces 100% of the next stage in the supply chain, spherical graphite, it's called. Mm-hmm. And that's the key step before it goes into a battery. So it's a very China-centric, China-dominant market. And at the moment, there's no new capacity in the US. There's one or two smaller projects, but it's definitely an issue that people need to focus on.
You never hear about that, actually. You always hear about lithium. Well, actually, more cobalt and nickel is more of a constraint. So that's really interesting. Tell us a bit about those other materials like lithium. Are we getting tight in that supply chain as well? And what are the options for adding new capacity?
Yeah, so lithium this year is the year where that excess supply is eaten up. I mean, you're seeing the tightness within China. In fact, you're seeing a shortage within China of lithium carbonate, primarily because of LFP batteries are in vogue and are going up in demand because they're also used in electric vehicles. And that's caused the lithium carbonate price to spike 70% in 2 months, as I mentioned. But for the market as a whole, as I said, this is the year that the market either goes into balance or into shortage. And everything's going to be very sensitive for the whole year. Mm-hmm. And the one thing people are watching for is whether the rest of the world prices snap. It's not a case of they're going up. You've already seen some movement of prices for lithium carbonate hydroxide outside of China nudging up, but it's whether they snap and they go up from, let's say, 20%, 30% in one hit. And that's the way these markets move. So that's certainly one to watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I want to come to the battery as a whole in a minute and the implication of a price snap to the battery. But before we do that, I mean, you mentioned the LFP, which is the lithium ferrophosphate type battery, which I think Tesla uses dominantly. Isn't that right?
Tesla just started using LFP in short range Model 3s in China. And it's very much a China rationale and story for Tesla there. But primarily, they were actually used in electric buses, and they still are. But they are finding increasing use in short-range cars. The upside is they're much cheaper, and they've got a lot better. We're really in this LFP 2.0 right now. Mm-hmm. But the problem is range, always, performance, always. And they're heavy. Lithium, iron, phosphate. There's iron in there. Iron's heavy. So it's not perfect, but it definitely fits the role that's needed at the moment within China.
Yeah, I think people don't really appreciate that people say, well, you can substitute out one of these things if it gets too expensive with something else, some other element. But there's always some kind of sacrifice, whether it's energy density, power density, range, how many times you can charge it in and out, the safety, and so on and so forth. I want to talk about the nickel side of it, because you put out a piece just very recently about nickel. And it reminded me again that even when we talk about nickel, there's different kinds of nickel. It's not just the Nickelix and stainless steel or something like that. There's this type 1, type 2. The purities are really important, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it underlines, let's say, nickel guys that would count themselves as commodity guys, there's a speciality element to this as well. And it's something maybe they haven't had to look into in depth before. But just underlines for a lithium-ion battery, this is a load of speciality chemicals that are put together in laboratory-like conditions that make the batteries that go into the EV. So very much a speciality that needs to be scaled, and nickel is a perfect example of that.
Now, cobalt's one you hear about a lot, and my understanding is that because cobalt spiked so much in its price several years ago, most batteries are moving away from cobalt and more towards nickel. We heard on the Tesla battery day that was their plan. So do you foresee cobalt to also be a constraint, or has it kind of been phased out enough?
Cobalt's interesting. We actually don't see a massive supply problem with cobalt initially from a high-level view of the market. That's not because cobalt's not being used. I mean, you're correct, Jackie. The trend in the market is to reduce the amount of cobalt on a battery and to increase the nickel. But the key role for cobalt is it's the great stabilizer. It ensures the battery doesn't have thermal runaway, it doesn't catch on fire, and you need cobalt in there to ensure that safety part of the EV. But of course, people don't like it because, well, there's a cost or volatility element to it, but of course there's a bad reputation element to it, which is unfair to cobalt, really. It's something the industry does need to sort anyway, and that's the child labor linked to the DRC. But for us, in summary, the trend is cobalt, whilst the intensity per car goes down, you're always going to need it. And the industry is growing at eightfold, eight times in 10 years. and the growth profile massively outweighs that trend of lowering intensity.
Yeah, when you say you sort of bring down the percentage of cobalt or nickel or whatever chemistry combinations that you're using, but it's completely overwhelmed by the overall pull in the demand for batteries as a whole. So talk about the fraction of a battery that is dependent upon these from a cost perspective. So in other words, if we do see these spikes up in these commodities, which we're seeing, what impact does that have on a battery and the narrative that the batteries are going to continue to come down in price?
Good question, Peter. This is really important trend, I think, for people to understand. And that where we've come from since 2014, 2015, almost when no one cared about batteries, but let's argue some people did. So 2015, the price of a lithium-ion battery to go into an EV was $280 a kilowatt hour. And it comes down to our last year automotive average at benchmark of $110 a kilowatt hour. Mm-hmm. Now, actually, that's an average, so some producers are getting it lower than that. The point about this is when you push the price of a battery cell down to that level, that down to around the $100 level, the proportion of the cost of raw materials increases. So we've gone from a world where raw materials were 50% of the battery to now the proportion of raw materials as a cost is upwards of 80% of the battery cost. Hmm. Now, if you think about the big ones that are in there, lithium, nickel, graphite as well, well, what happens when that price goes up 4x? The last time that happened was 4 years ago when that battery cost was much higher. The problem now is I think automotive companies and certainly battery makers will very quickly see if they haven't got that price stabilized in that contract in long-term fixed price or stable-ish price, the battery price is going to go up. And that's something that people haven't really discussed yet in detail.
Yeah, it's really an important point. And there's a number of dynamics here. So we've got big automakers, General Motors, for example, piling in. We've got a smorgasbord of startup companies, whether it's the Rivians of the world and others that are coming into play. How many of these automakers have actually secured supply forward at a constant price?
Generally, what happens with automotive companies, they think, well, we need batteries. So then lock in their gigawatt hours per year. In like some contracts are really rock solid, some are very loose agreements, but they lock in their batteries and think they're sorted. But have they then asked whether the battery supplier has locked in their lithium, has locked in their nickel? And that hasn't really happened. And there's sometimes where big automotive companies have kind of bypassed the battery producer or let's say worked in tandem to lock the raw material in and that and to take on that price risk, that kind of capital risk, if you like. But the reality is that the problem hasn't fully been solved. And if you think about the market environment, it's only now that we're going into where this relationship is really going to be tested. So it'll be interesting in the next 18 months to see when these prices go up, how will automotive companies react?
Yeah, how will they react? I mean, it strikes me like some of the, well, Teslas of the world that are now very large and the big players have the wherewithal to be able to lock in their supply chains at what price, we don't know. But as I said, the smorgasbord of smaller players that are entering the market at incredibly lofty valuations and expectations of how many vehicles they're going to sell. But I think they're completely naked to the forward market for these minerals.
Of course, if you don't have the raw material security of supply, you're not going to make your batteries. If you haven't got your batteries locked in, you're not going to make the cars. And an important point is you can't use all lithium-ion batteries in all EVs. There are tiers of quality of batteries, certainly for Western mm-hmm. quality or electric cars. I mean, the key thing that what Tesla have done, which Tesla are always 3, 4, 5 years ahead of the rest of the automotive industry on this, and it's the same with the supply chain, have a look at what they're doing in Austin. Austin, of course, we're familiar with the Terra factory. We're familiar with Elon Musk's grand plan to make a lot of batteries there, and Tesla's own batteries is the goal. But it's key to know they're making their own cathode there, and they've announced that. They're making their own lithium hydroxide there, which they didn't really announce on Battery Day, but there's an exclusive on our website. You type in Tesla, lithium hydroxide, and benchmark, it pops up. And that explains their plan. And they're also doing nickel sulfate. So they're not just comfortable enough going one step before the battery. They're actually going to the raw materials. And I actually think that's a blueprint and a template for the Western car industry going forward.
Right. So the other manufacturers are more relying on third parties to make the batteries, where Tesla's got the whole supply chain, right? They're actually making their own batteries and going as far as to get into the minerals. Is that the difference?
Exactly. Tesla are the first automotive company ever in history to get involved in lithium production, even though it's a spodumene conversion facility in Texas to make lithium hydroxide. And that is by far a first. But is it a last? I don't think so, because I think, can the car industry rely on the mining industry to supply them? Or do they need to get active themselves? I think there's a balance to be struck. But it's so far out of the comfort zone of Detroit that it will be interesting to see if they can shift that, because it's going to be crucial.
Right, because you're saying that we're already tight. It could take 4 to 5 years to add the mining capacity. So everyone's got these expectations that between now and 2025, there's going to be a huge ramp up, a hockey curve type growth in EV sales. And it's possible that this isn't going to happen just because of the material shortage.
Yeah, 100%. That's a really good point, Jackie. And actually, something you said at the start of that comment is pertinent. It takes 7 years to build a lithium mine. It takes 24 months to build a battery plant. That's your disconnect. We call it the great raw material disconnect. And that kind of sums up the story.
So what is the current situation in the world for some of these mines? Are the mines coming? Like, what stage are they at in terms of this 7-year cycle? It's obviously different for nickel, for copper, which we haven't even talked about, and these other mines.
For lithium, and I think that's been the case for most raw materials, we're relying on investments made 5 years ago, plans made probably 10 years ago for the next wave of supply, the next 5 years. I mean, with lithium, for example, the next big one that we're looking forward to is Lithium Americas coming on stream. And there's expansions at spodumene facilities. But actually, where else is the lithium, new lithium, not existing, not the base load, but new lithium being pulled out of the ground? And there's no new mega projects coming through. There's absolute lack of foresight in the industry. And I think it's the same for a lot of these raw materials.
Yeah, I mean, lithium actually is one of the more common elements in the Earth's crust. Then we get to something we haven't even talked about, the rare earths, the neodymium, dysprosium, those kind of elements that are used in electric motors and other components that are also vital to this whole electrification trend. And then platinum for fuel cells, palladium, these sorts of things. What's going on that side of the business?
On the platinum side, I actually don't know. I call that old school automotive, and electric vehicles are new school. But the fundamental problem is the same for all these raw materials, is that the mining industry lives on geological timescale, and their investment cycles and appetite for investment, the investment cycles are long, and the appetite for riskier investments are diminishing. And I think, especially for EV raw materials, the industry has to scale, as I said, 8 to 10x in the next decade. I spoke to high up people, let's say at Rio Tinto and Anglo American, about this, who have been in the game a long time. And I said to them, look, your classic commodities, have you actually seen a similar growth path in such a short period for all the other raw materials that you're dealing with? They both said something similar as iron ore back in the 70s. But even then, that wasn't like this. It wasn't as intense and as rapid as this. Yeah. So it's new for everybody.
Now, people often say it's not such a big deal. We can just change the batteries. In fact, I just listened to a podcast this morning that was talking about, even with the existing gigafactories, we could change the materials out, like do a different cathode and anode. And how hard is that?
Well, they're both powders. The cathode and anode are very, very fine powders that are then mixed with solvents and then essentially spread onto sheets of copper or aluminium. They're like an old cassette, like making an old tape cassette or something. Same kind of process. But the key thing is, so if you're dealing with fine powders that can be mixed in with solvents and spread onto sheets, then yeah, for sure. But the fundamental way of making batteries, I think, will remain the same for a long time. The key is tweaking these powders. So, you know, you're using an NCM, a nickel cobalt manganese. Well, can you then add a bit of aluminium oxide in there? Or add another element that just boosts your energy density by like 3 to 5%. And I think the key path forward for the vast, vast majority of the battery industry is adding these little additives, making their own special sauce, but fundamentally the way they're made stays the same.
We've talked about the supply generically and this huge looming ramp up. Then on top of all of this, there's a geopolitical overlay where it comes from. I mean, you talked about China. We know that a lot of Western countries are not on the most favorable terms with China. And then we have the issues in some of the African countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo, like DRC, which has historically ethical issues, a country that seems to be in perpetual civil war. How does all that manifest itself into price?
Well, high level, the battery supply chain, actually, even more importantly, lithium-ion batteries are very geopolitical. The classic case of a raw material, an element or a group of elements being geopolitical is rare earths. That's like the most extreme case of where 85% comes from China. But China does use it as a political weapon and blocked exports to Japan 10 years ago. And as a result, it terrifies Washington, D.C. But for us, the trend here is actually these battery mega factories or gigafactories becoming geopolitical. And therefore, by extension, it will make all the supply chains and all those inputs become geopolitical as well eventually. But the trend at the moment is these massive battery plants are becoming focal points for countries and industries' ambition and scale for this energy revolution.
There was a recent situation, I noticed you tweeted about it, about the United States recently banning SK EV batteries in the U.S. for 10 years. What was the driver? Is that because they want to create more batteries at home and not have the imports?
Well, the driver was from the U.S. ITC, International Trade Commission, made that ruling on SK. And it's a dispute between LG Chem and SK on American soil, two Korean heavyweight battery producers, of course, LG being the biggest. And a dispute on American soil. And I think what it puts into focus is actually how important now, and only recently, in this case, sums it up, how important scaling battery supply for the US is becoming. Because the US has lagged significantly behind China and Europe in this. But now it's becoming a focal point, and now it's becoming political. And of course, you saw the White House on top of all of that give an executive order on supply chains 2 weeks ago or so. Of course, people like it's about semiconductors, but it wasn't. It was about semiconductors and lithium-ion batteries. And of course, we knew at Benchmark, this isn't just about semiconductors. The key is it's gone right to the top now in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Well, and President Biden has said he wants to create a supply chain for producing batteries at home. Canada has said that as well. I know Canada and the U.S. have entered into a collaboration on critical minerals. You know, is it possible that as people start looking at the supply chain, and I think COVID has made that even more important for people to think about being less dependent on imports, could we actually see a big investment and this expand supply and not have the supply constraints that maybe we're thinking about today because of these government investments potentially?
Yeah, I think if you combine where the industry is at from a fundamental EV perspective, plus on top where the world is in a geopolitical perspective, and on top of that, COVID, this whole blanket of COVID, it's sped up the future and has put the past very quickly in our rear view. I think all of those combined means everything's on the table, including massive government investment to kickstart this, which, of course, in theory is against American principles of free market, but actually has been a core part of your history going back to FDR days. And I think we're going through another cycle of that now where the government will have to step in to turbocharge this and attract private investment, because this is a race against time now. And this is why we call this the global battery arms race.
Yeah. But I mean, there's all sorts of other overlays, like environmental overlays, because the whole ESG around the mining industry and where you permit in the Western countries is a huge issue as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a really good point. You've got this, let's say, green revolution going on, which is a massive positive, of course, but everything comes out the ground or you grow it. And that's as simple as that.
Yeah.
And as a result, you've got these drags as well. And when I call them drags, I mean, some of them are drags. And actually, it's red tape holding back a lot of these crucial mines. And some of them are good for the industry, like the ESG moment, if you like, or let's say the blooming of ESG principles, is to make these supply chains 21st century secure. Like, we know where the raw material comes from, they're transparent and they are responsible. And that's absolutely crucial. You can't be making the world better through all these renewable energy and electric vehicle technologies when you aren't improving the supply chains and how they're extracted and how they travel through the world at the same time. So they definitely both have to go hand in hand.
Well, I can't help but think as we wrap up the time here, you've been very kind with your time. Thanks, Simon. I'll offer you a couple of historical flashbacks, you know, with respect to the comments on Tesla doing the full supply chain. You know, that is not new to Detroit, because a century ago, Ford, for example, used to have its own steel factories to make the engines. They were fully integrated right back to the iron ore. And it seems like a little bit of a replay there as well. This seems eerily similar to 1969, where we had a tremendous pull on oil. At that time in the late 60s, oil consumption was growing by, I don't know, 7 or 8% per year leading into the 70s. And then, of course, we had the oil price shocks with a geopolitical overlay in the 1970s. So there's some really interesting parallels that seem to be happening as the world rushes to, once again, figure out where it's going to get its natural resources from and what price it's going to have to pay to get it out of the ground.
And actually, one more point on top of that, fascinating examples, actually. I made some notes there, but one more example is Fordlandia. Google Fordlandia, L-A-N-D-I-A, and what Ford did with rubber plantations in Brazil. Mm. Didn't end well, don't get me wrong, but there was a shortage of rubber tires for when they made their cars. So Henry Ford said, well, we need to start growing rubber plants. Of course, didn't end well, but the thought process is back in that time zone. And so it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds.
Well, as I've always said, the new economy relies heavily on the old economy. The two must coexist. Fascinating discussion, Simon. Thank you so much for taking the time being with us. There's so much more we could talk about. We haven't even talked about copper. We haven't even talked about, apparently, there's sand shortages potentially for silicon and all sorts of other things. But we'll leave that for another time.
Yes, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate the invite and having me on.
Great. And thank you to our listeners. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to. Leave a comment and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.